Grow CFO is where finance leaders grow together. Join thousands of like-minded professionals using Grow CFO to access the combined knowledge and experience of the finance leader community. You can join us today at growcfo.net. Hello and welcome to the Grow CFO show. Today we're talking finance transformation and my guest is Anthony Perosi, who is a full-time finance transformation expert. Anthony, welcome to the Grow CFO show.
Oh, Kevin, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Anthony, say you're a full-time finance transformation person. Now, that hasn't always been the case. Tell me a little bit about your backstory and how you came to gather that expertise.
Certainly. Well, Kevin, as I think finance transformation is a journey. It's not a start or an end point. So to that effect, early on in my career, I started out as a finance and accounting graduate. So initially, I wanted to pursue either getting my CPA or one of the management accounting designations. And I felt a little bit later on in my career, when I got some experience behind me, I knew that there was something more outside of the textbooks. So my first kind of foray into the transformation space was really working in the systems that deliver the finance and accounting background. I worked in Oracle PeopleSoft as a staff accountant, and then later on as a manager. And I realized quickly that there's easier and more efficient ways to do things within the system than what I'm currently presented with. And so I would always be the accountant in the room that would raise my hand and go, well, why can't we do it differently? Why do we have to stick with the status quo with what's in the system? And at that time, I didn't have a lot of experience or leadership qualities behind me. So many times I was asked to defer to somebody else or hold my questions for a later time. So when I realized years later, as I came into the management space, I started to get more of those leadership opportunities. And I took those opportunities to really look at the system and enhance it the way that it should be. And from there, Kevin, it was just a matter of getting nominated by my peers, sometimes even my manager, to sit in as a representative for the controllership division to make key decisions on new system upgrades or implementations.
Yeah, so that's quite a story. I recognize some parallels with myself there. And I suppose I got thrown into finance transformation because we had in the chemical organization I worked in, we had a huge systems implementation of management accounting systems. And I became one of the key sort of business users in the implementation of it. And later, the business that I worked for was sold and we wound up in a new company and all the systems we were used to using disappeared. So there's where finance transformation starts. How on earth do we report some numbers with completely different systems? How do we make this work? Yeah. And it really makes you think, as you said earlier, these are all skills that nobody ever taught you to pass your CPA exams.
I mean, your point is exactly spot on, Kevin. There's no textbook or there's no path that's already well traveled by somebody else that kind of shows you how to undergo a transformation. And you really have to pick up the skills on the job, as I'm sure you found out.
Yeah, indeed. Which is actually why in Grow CFO, we went on and we've launched the Finance Transformation Bootcamp. So we can take people that probably fit the exact mold that you and I were years ago and say, okay, let's take you through 7 workshops. We'll teach you how to do finance transformation. Now, there are so many moving parts to it, Anthony, from planning projects to selecting systems to understanding change management. So you certainly got into the finance transformation space, but no, you're out on your own running your own business now. How did that happen?
Well, as with most events in life, I think it kind of takes you by surprise a little bit. You kind of know when a new moment is going to approach, whether it be professionally or personally, but you don't quite know exactly when it's going to hit. But there usually are signs. And the sign for me was being basically a design lead for a global implementation at a Fortune 500 company. This was about 6 years ago, roughly. I was in this global design role. We had essentially re-engineered the entire intercompany accounting process globally for the entire company. This Fortune 500 company happened to have 55 offices in 55 different countries, controllers in every country with a different perspective and opinion. And we got one intercompany policy out of that entire gamut.
Yeah. So intercompany sounds simple, but when you put it to that scale of things, it's not. Darn complex change.
That's exactly right. If you look at the textbook, it's supposed to be a net zero game, right? Eliminations are supposed to take care of the intercompany entries. Trust me, that is not always the case, especially when you have that type of a volume. is not a net zero. In any case, so having completed that implementation, it was a 3-year long project. At the end of the project, my manager had basically had a conversation with me and said, Anthony, now that we've implemented this thing and it's running smoothly, you can return to your BA, which I was a senior manager overseeing basically intercompany accounting policy and technical structure. And I said, well, now that I've been a part of this 3-year journey, implementing something that has had so much, delivered so much value to the company, I don't really want to go back to BAU.
That's kind of a step backwards after what you've been doing.
Exactly. And so my manager looked at me puzzled and said, well, this is really the only opportunity that's available because, you know, the way that our GBS or global business services is set up, we need you to return to overseeing the intercompany architecture. And so the conversation ended, I would say, pretty abruptly after that. And I found out just a couple of months later, following that conversation, that I was made redundant by the company. After being made redundant, there was a reset in my life to determine, well, number one, how do I stop this from happening again? And how do I prevent this situation from happening again? And two, how do I find an organization or organizations that are going to truly appreciate the value that I bring? And as you can imagine, Kevin, the answer to those two questions was, well, why don't I just go out on my own?
Right. And I suppose when it's a redundancy situation, it makes it just a little bit easier financially than going and saying to an employer, oh, I'm leaving on Monday, because the sum of money suddenly stops if you resign, but it doesn't necessarily stop as quickly if you're made redundant.
That's correct. There are packages that are offered to employees that are made redundant in the US, but I believe by global standards, not anywhere near how employees are taken care of in other parts of the world. So I didn't have that much runway. So it actually kind of, it lit a fire under me to really get going. And so when that fire was lit, I found my first opportunity basically in the New York City metro area. And I said, well, it was a 6-month contract with opportunity for extension. And I said, well, this is as good of a start as any. I might as well just get going. So I packed my bags and...
I'm seeing a very similar thing. I was involved in a big internal transformation operation in our own company, which was failing very badly. We were trying to take cost out and save the business. Got to the stage that the transformation team had to get rid of themselves because we just couldn't do the job. I ended up in a similar situation to you, Anthony, of being made redundant and thinking, yep, I can do this myself. But the big one there is, where does that first contract come from? Did you find it or did it find you?
So that's an interesting question. It was a little bit of both, actually. So I had posted my CV on a number of different typical career services sites, and there was a recruiter that was looking actively for this contract. And basically, they had contacted me on the basis of my CV. So they'd reached out to me directly and said, we think you'd be a great fit for this opportunity. It's a short-term contract, but the client is really looking for somebody that can basically independently run the accounts payable workstream for this new system transformation. I said, okay, put me in. So she put my name in the hat for the client. I interviewed with the client, I believe, a week after. And the week after that, I was provided the offer. It was bing, bang.
So that's 6 months. Is that fairly typical of a project for you? Or do you do things that are longer or shorter?
Sure. Most implementations that involve a significant finance transformation effort, they're usually anywhere from 6 months to 18 months. With the average, I would say, if you look at the bell curve, the average is probably right around a year or a little over a year.
Yeah. So you're typically working for one client at a time, probably a year at a time.
That's correct.
Yeah. That's possibly similar to my experience. And like you, made redundant, there was a little bit of the opportunity found me via me using network a little bit when I knew how to find something. And this opportunity came along to do a transformation piece or at least look at something for initial 3-month contract. 3 months kept getting extended. In the end, 21 months, which you can't complain about. So, Anthony, what do you find the commonest problems are when you're going into a new client looking to start a transformation? What sort of things are generally the issues?
Listen, Kevin, this is a great question and one that I have, I would say, addressed in multiple different forms throughout my career. One of the primary forms being content creation on LinkedIn. So I wrote an article a couple of years ago, and I'm happy to provide it to our listeners and anybody else who's interested to read the full version. But it was published a couple of years ago, and it's top 5 reasons why implementations and or finance transformations go wrong. So I've got 5 for you. The first one being internal under-resourcing. this is by far the biggest problem that I see anytime I step into a client site, because when they want to commit to a major transformation, what they don't realize is you need to actually commit the resources as well behind it. The money's not enough. So you need the staff, folks that are expected to do their day jobs or their business as usual. They cannot be committed to a full-time transformation. You literally have to backfill these key stakeholders so that they can truly contribute to the design, the build, and the test of whatever model that we're putting through.
Yeah, that's always an interesting question. That's, do you bring extra resource on? Do you bring extra resource straight into the project team? Or do you bring the extra resource in so you can release people from the business?
Exactly.
I've always found it's better to release people from the business because you need that local knowledge in the project team. It's invaluable.
Absolutely. The hard decisions need to be made by the executive team. And typically, just speaking very bluntly here, typically the executive team does not understand the level of effort that it takes for a major transformation. So what they do is they end up underscoring what commitment is required from the existing business resources. And as a result, they really hamper the progress of the transformation because they're not willing to free up these folks. Because in the CFO's mind, or even let's call it the FD or the finance director's mind, oh, month-end close BAU comes first. Okay, if that's your opinion, then you're going to get the same month-end close cycle time results that you had in the past. You're not going to get any transformation.
So that's reason one.
Correct. One of five. Number two, so suboptimal request for proposals or RFPs. Now, many times, some companies decide to perform the transformation in-house, in which case you don't need an RFP. So my point number two is probably moot for those folks. Now, in the cases where you are doing a major transformation, let's say you're a Fortune 500 company and you want to upgrade your existing platform, or you want to spend money and you want to get something new. There's a lot of new SaaS products on the market, many that are competing for big organizations' attention, and many of them require a full-time staff just to go ahead and build the platform. So when the company is deciding how to write and how to issue their RFP, they need to take some things into consideration. Number one, if you hire one of the big four, when I say big four, I'm referring to the US consulting oligarchy. So when you hire one of the big four, many times they staff appropriately for the build, but they don't staff appropriately for the strategy. So what happens is, and you've probably seen this many times, Kevin, in your career, the big four come in there, they've got six or seven junior resources that are ready to start plugging information into the keyboard, but none of them have the strategy experience. Typically, there's one individual, maybe it's a manager or senior manager at the firm, that comes in part-time to kind of oversee and do helicopter strategy. Not good enough. I've seen this many times, especially in the last 5 years in my experience. I've seen this where it's had awful results for the client, because they didn't understand the staffing situation. The way it was supplemented is by bringing in somebody like myself or another transformation strategy advisor. Having a full-time advisor just to do not only the strategic work, but the, I'll call it the conductor, the coordination work among the folks is key. You do not have this person, the transformation will, it may not fail ultimately, but you will go live with a number of problems.
I think we've often called that particular role you describe as the client-side advisor.
That's right.
Transformation. And that I found myself, or along with colleagues, we've been playing that role of client-side advisor on a number of occasions, telling whoever it is from the big four what to do.
That's exactly right. And this is why you and I had been able to carve out our own independent advisory firms. There's a demand, but the supply is very low.
Yeah. So we've got two reasons, Anthony. Reason number three.
Sure. So reason three, lack of cross-functional impact analysis. Now, that's a lot of words, but basically what I'm saying there is when you have a number of different finance departments or areas that need to work together, you truly need to work together in an integrated way. So for example, if I'm an accounts payable clerk, I should understand what's happening downstream once my vendor invoices get paid. I should understand how the cash is being handled. How's the settlement taking place? Many times, even in today's organizations, believe it or not, many AP clerks have no understanding of the other functions. They say, oh, I checked the box. ABC company's invoice has been paid. My job is done. Right? They washed their
hands. That's so many times, Anthony, where you've got a lot of very good individuals that know their part of the process inside out and are pretty darn good at it. But out of half a dozen individuals involved in bits of the process, no one of those half dozen individuals knows the whole process.
And that's exactly right. And this is why you run into the situation where you're working with folks that are very good, as you mentioned, at their individual tasks or the responsibilities in their department, but nobody has that broad-based view. And that the broad-based view is very important. It's a gap. It's a gap in many organizations, and either it needs to be filled from the inside, or somebody, again, like this client-side advisor role that we talk about, somebody needs to come in like me or like you to take a look and understand how the pieces fit together.
Yeah. So how do you go about that?
You don't. My methodology is pretty simple, actually. So I conduct a series of working sessions with each of the subject matter experts in the different areas. When I end up being on the client site within the first week or so, that's when I try to get the most time with each of these folks. So I usually contact key stakeholders in the procure to pay area, the record to report work stream, you know, your month end close staff, and also your order to cash. Who's doing AR? Who's doing billing? These are the three areas I focus on. And I basically host, I'll call it informal conversations with key members of these teams. From those meetings, I get the pain points and the key process issues that they've been experiencing while they've been in the role. I document all that. I listen very carefully. During that first week of workshops, I do 20% talking, 80% listening. That's how it gets done.
So what sort of output do you end up with from those? Is it just a load of notes, or are you drawing process charts?
That's a good question. Depending on the client need, if they don't have process documentation in place, typically I will draft something for them. And I find that many times, you'd be surprised, Kevin, whether it's a startup or a small to medium-sized company, or somebody that's multinational with thousands of employees, both don't have appropriate process flow documentation.
That does not surprise me at all. I've seen it so many times myself.
Yeah, I figured this was not a surprise for you. So that's one of the first things that I always try to understand when I hold these conversations with the experts. I say, hey, if you have anything else that you'd like to share with me after the meeting, maybe you have a reference guide that you use to work through the system challenges, or maybe you have a standard operating procedure, an SLA, that kind of dictates when you're supposed to respond to a certain thing. If you can provide me that documentation, that will help me in this journey. What I do is I take those artifacts, and if I don't see a single consistent flow that's easy to understand, I develop one myself.
Yeah. Asking that question for the standard operating procedures is sometimes an interesting one, because there are lots of cases where they don't exist either. The upshot of that is generally you might get two or three people doing roughly the same role in different parts of the organization, and there are three similar but subtly different ways of doing the same thing.
Absolutely right. And again, this is an opportunity for, you bring up a great example where going through the process of transformation can help you identify issues. And so when you take a look at that, and that in your interview process and your streamlining, that two people are doing roughly the same thing, that's an opportunity to rationalize.
Forgive me, Anthony, was that number three or number four?
That was number three.
That was number three. We've got two more to do. So number four.
Certainly. So number four, I would say really lack of applying rationalization initiatives. So with rationalization initiatives, you're looking at, these are activities that need to precede the transformation. Now, it's difficult for many clients to understand what those type of rationalization activities are without understanding the output of the transformation. So normally when I come into a client site and I talk to the main stakeholders and I get a feel for what the overall process is in between the three key areas, I'm able to then work backwards and determine, hey, if you would like to reduce your month-end cycle time by 3 business days, here are the prerequisite activities that you need to line up before we get to the point where we start to accelerate your month-end. So for example, I want you to look at key rationalization activity in the sequence would be intercompany. I want you to take a look at your intercompany out of balances. Do you have entries that are, if they're not leading up to a net zero number, why is there a variance? We need to go through, we need to comb through the books. We need to understand exactly why that out of balance is created. And if we have enough runway between now and when the transformation kicks off, we need to go ahead and resolve the out of balances. So whatever that takes, if it takes 3 or 4 resources full time over the next 3 months, then we need to do that. I request the client to commit those resources. And Kevin, these are hard conversations. They're not easy conversations to have, but you have to, if you want to create value by saving costs, you need to think about these type of things. Where can I commit my resources?
And transformation is very much a place where you've got to spend money in order to save money.
That's correct. And just anything, right? Even if you purchase like a new vehicle, for example, and you know that new vehicle is going to run for a number of years without much maintenance, there will come a point, let's say 5 or 7 years down the line, where it will require some sort of minimal maintenance. But if you want to keep that performance, you want to keep your vehicle at a superior performance, you have to invest. Now, whether you invest now or you invest 5 years from now, the investment still needs to come.
Indeed. So number 5.
Number 5, last but definitely not least, this is the concept that I refer to as finance enablement. Now, this term, and Kevin, perhaps you've used it in your experience because we're in a similar field. Finance enablement is basically the definition of committing to identifying what are the gaps in your current state processes and what do you then need to enable in order to close down those process gaps. So this is basically a continuation of what I had mentioned in number 4 in the previous statement. When you go through these rationalization exercises and you find opportunities to clean up business as usual, part of that cleanup is being directed toward a way to improve or resolve a process gap. So if we take the example of intercompany accounting, if I apply the finance enablement principle, what I'm basically saying is, in order to speed up your month-end close as your output, we need to fix your intercompany accounting out of balances, which is one of your root causes. And the enablement is the process of cleaning up the out of balances until the point where we have an improved month-end close. So it's kind of like the bridge from start to finish. So 4 and 5, I would say, are pretty interrelated, but I like to call them out separately because they do achieve specific points in the process.
So an awful lot of what you're describing here is process improvement rather than just take a system and implement something new.
Indeed. I would fully agree with that. In transformation, this is why the definition, and I know you've probably got a significant perspective of your own, given your career path. Transformation is a combination of people, process, and technology. You cannot improve or enhance one without having impact or understanding on how the other two are affected. And so when I walk into any given client situation, I always try to figure out how can I get the three to harmonize together. Now, normally, my go-to lever is to work on process first. Because when I work on process, the technology will definitely follow. Because as long as the technology can support the improvement in the process, that's an easy one.
A whole load of transformation we're seeing at the moment, Anthony, looks as though it's being technology-driven. Everybody's talking about automation, artificial intelligence. Therefore, folk are saying, well, we're going to put this new system in. How do you square that with fixing the process?
I have one statement to align these. Process before automation. I know that there are a lot of people out there, a lot of professionals, even on our LinkedIn platform, that say AI is going to change the game entirely. It's going to transform lives, et cetera. And all of that is true, but to a certain extent, without the process being in place in a way that people can use and can understand, you can automate the heck out of a process. But if the underlying process is not good, it's not a stable one, the AI is not really going to do much to improve your overall operations, honestly.
And you come back to the old saying, garbage in, garbage out.
Absolutely. So you cannot stack AI on top of bad processes because you're going to get, as you said, garbage in, garbage out. And I always subscribe to the philosophy that the process has to come first.
I reflect back to that case where I mentioned earlier that my last big corporate job was in as part of our own internal transformation team. We were putting together, trying to rip some cost out of the back office, some shared services. And we discovered that a couple of years before this happened, there was an SAP implementation. Everybody took SAP on. But all that they'd done was effectively put into SAP the processes that were already there. And though there seemed to be one common accounting system across the business, because there were seven or eight different finance teams, there were seven or eight ways of doing everything, even with a system that would, on first glance, seem to need standard processes like SAP.
I'm shaking my head as you're telling me that story, because this is your standard lift and shift approach, which never works. It ultimately sets up the organization for, I would say, imminent failure.
Yeah. And it did in our case, because while we tried to change things, the one time I believe you should not be trying big transformation is when the organization's in trouble, because you've got to spend money to save money. We didn't have any money to spend. And we found that there were so many things like this that were very difficult to change that we were on a battle to getting not very far from word go. We were always on the back foot.
Of course. And unfortunately, the situation you're describing, Kevin, many clients are on the back foot when it comes to initiating a transformation. Because again, they don't line up. I'll go back to my top five reasons, right? Number one, they don't line up the resources. If you don't have the appropriate resources and capacity for those resources in place, you're always going to be behind the eight ball. You're not going to be able to move significant progress in any transformation.
So we touched on AI. It is the big buzzword of the moment. How much AI are you actually seeing as you're doing transformation projects in practice?
The most common one that I see, and I would say I'm focusing more on the multinational space, so not so much startups and small to medium-sized businesses. I see a lot of robotics, so RPA. So when it's necessary to be able to perform automation either inside the system or outside of the system, RPA is typically where clients first start to look. And so what they'll do is they'll have on staff a developer with significant experience, either in, if they want to automate it, modeling in Excel, they may have a VBA expert, for example, in-house that can do that. That's one major case that I typically see. If they're looking to do some of that modeling or additional automation within the system, they may get a developer off the street that specializes in the system to do custom additions. So I've seen a few different cases where true AI and machine learning, and let's say more of the advanced automation comes into play, it's starting to take place. And a lot of people are talking about, oh, ChatGPT can do this. It can write me, it can balance my books, it can generate answers for any standardized tests that I have to take. But if you look at the results, and I published an article on this some time ago, if you look at some of the results, that percentage of success rate for a platform like ChatGPT actually isn't that good. There was a survey that was done at a university where students were preparing for standardized exam, and ChatGPT provided the answer prompt. And I think the percentage was somewhere around 50% or under. That actually passed. So listen, I think there's enough conversation to warrant some buzz around this area, but I would say it's still in its infancy stages. We're not anywhere near where it's going to take a process and build it for you.
So we've talked about the five big things that companies tend to get wrong. What do you find most of the time when you're going into an organization is driving the need to change? Is it, oh, we need to close faster? Oh, we need to save money? Oh, we need better payroll. Oh, we've got a huge error rate. What is it that's generally sparking the burning platform to transform?
I would say identification of lots of non-value-add activities. So, for example, if the CFO is seeing at the very top, if he's seeing his people are working a lot on data reconciliation and data rationalization, that's usually the number one key. When the CFO or the FD starts to see that activity, they want to bring in a consulting team ASAP to start the transformation. Now, again, going back to our earlier conversation, what they don't understand is if you want to be able to eliminate these non-value-add activities, so for example, if you have three different systems producing, let's say you have three different subledgers that are contributing transactional sources to the overall general ledger, and all three of those subledgers need to be massaged before they reach the financial statements, we can consolidate that for you in a transformation initiative, but you have to be willing to pull the resources off of that in order to help us design something that's going to work. And that's where the program usually falls down, because the CFO and the FD, whoever's in charge, they're not willing to commit.
So the reporters are normally too busy doing the reconciliations of the data to stand back and work out, well, what are the problems that are causing this data not to reconcile in the first place?
Correct. That's absolutely it.
Looking forward into 2024 and beyond, Anthony, what do you think the big challenges are going to be?
You couldn't have asked a tougher question, but I'm glad you did, because I think it's one that needs to be explored. And I'd love to hear from also other of your guests and other listeners that are interested in this topic. What I would say is, number one, really understanding and embracing the value of finance transformation. Now, I know that may come as a surprise to you, because there's a lot of good content out there that's getting produced. I produce some content. There's a number of other people on the LinkedIn platform that produce very good transformation content. But I would say, in comparison to, let's say, more commonplace areas of understanding like a FP&A or budgeting or controllership, those areas are much more well understood, and there's a lot more content practitioners in those other areas. Transformation, I think we're at a more of a tipping point for transformation, because there's a select group of content creators out there in the space, but the term and the impact of what it does is not widely understood yet in the finance community. Just take a look at the number of impressions that, like I said, FP&A, modeling, budgeting, those topics, look at the number of impressions those content receive on the platform compared to transformation. It's a very significant gap.
It is. So opportunity there for us to get into that space properly and shake it up a bit. But I'd agree. But fine, putting all this stuff on LinkedIn, it just tells you the what to do. Doesn't necessarily give you the how to do it, does it?
That's right. And the how to do it, that's part of our secret sauce. And that's why I always recommend, if you're interested, that send me a message. If you're interested in the content that I put out there and you want to have a conversation just about transformation overall, I encourage that. I always encourage my readers, my followers to do that. And that's where it all starts, because being educated on the topic of transformation is the beginning point. I'm much more interested in making sure that the community understands the impact, and that the actual strategy work come naturally from that.
That's kind of why we put the Grow CFO Finance Transformation Bootcamp together as well. We were looking around and saying, well, hold on, there's quite a lot around about FP&A, business partnering, but there isn't very much around to tell you how to do transformation. But there are so many moving parts to transformation. I can find little bits that might tell me a bit about business planning. I can see little bits that might tell me something about change management. But there's kind of nothing that pulls the whole thing together. And we thought, well, hang on a minute. A lot of businesses need their own internal transformation people. You can go find consultants like you or I to play a role, but we need lots more people on the transformation team that know how to do this stuff. How do you train those people up? How do you give them more than the what? How do you start teaching the how? And that's where the bootcamp came in. So
that's great.
If you want to know more, folks, talk to Anthony. Talk to me, talk to Dan Wells, talk to Ollie Deacon. We can really help you get up to speed with transformation.
Absolutely. And even though there's a few of us that Kevin has just mentioned, there's others that are up and coming in the community also that are starting to contribute. So I'm excited to see where this space takes us, Kevin. And I'm looking forward to partnering up on transformation education. And maybe just one statement in closing for our guests and our listeners. Transformation, it's a dynamic field. There's constant new information, constant new methodologies that folks are coming up with in the community to be able to drive value add, important transformative efforts in your organization. There's just a lot of good material out there, and I'm sure the bootcamp is a great place to start. So as a matter of fact, I think I'm going to sign up after our call today.
Brilliant. Anthony, that has been fascinating. Thank you for being this week's guest on the Grow CFO Show.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.